Good morning. Welcome to another International Connection. This is show number 30 in the series on mind control. And today we're going to hear an interview with Blanche Chavousty, a survivor of various U.S. government mind control experiments. Blanche is the American coordinator for AICS-MC, the Advocacy Committee for Human Experimentation Survivors of Mind Control, who are currently engaged in a campaign to open a government investigation into the mind control experiments. In this interview, Blanche is alleging that she was experimented on at various sites such as Cornell Medical Center in New York, Hollywood Hospital in Vancouver, Syracuse University, and the Princeton Parapsychology Lab, all of which have been documented to be sites involved in the CIA MK-Ultra mind control project. Her accounts include her being experimented on with brain implants, synthetic telepathy, drugs, and hypnosis, and she has been harassed repeatedly throughout her life. Here now is her interview. Welcome to the program, Blanche.
Good morning. Nice to be here.
I'd like to start off by asking you if you could tell us how you first came to suspect that mind control was being used on you.
Well, it was a long, hard struggle to discover it, actually. In 1989, I started experiencing harassment almost daily and stalking. It would happen at least a few times a week, sometimes every day. And sometimes it happened when my friends were with me, but usually it happened when I was by myself. Also, very weird phone messages would be left. And I just didn't know what to make of it. I wasn't clear where it was coming from. The only thing I knew was that whoever was doing it had to have a lot of money because they had resources to spend to have people following me. In May of 1990, after very, very severe harassment, I was kidnapped. I was kidnapped and taken to Cornell Medical Center in Westchester. There I was put into isolation, and they tried to force me to take drugs, which are written of as chemical straitjackets, drugs of punishment and control, and there was really no reason for this. I was trying to explain to them that, yes, I am upset, but I'm being harassed, and I have witnesses to it. I invite you to speak with them. They wouldn't speak to the witnesses.
How did they kidnap you?
A person who worked at the hospital, who I had never met before, tricked me into his car. And once I was at the hospital, there was like no way I could get away. I realized what was going on. I tried to leave the building, and six people surrounded me and put me on the floor, and I was trapped.
And what was their purported reason for keeping you at the hospital?
Well, it changed during the time that I was there. They insisted that I was hearing voices, even though I said that I wasn't, even though I have the records now which show when the person did intake with me that when she said, "Do you hear voices?" that I said, "No, I don't hear voices." She insisted that some people insisted that I was suicidal, even though I said no, and every single entry makes reference to that.
In your medical record of that?
In the medical record, which is 120 pages. And they must have asked me 30 times while I was there, and every single entry says, you know, that my response was no. But one of the doctors wrote several times that she has hidden suicidal ideation. So even though I said no, this isn't true, they insisted that it was. And the first day that I was there, first morning that I was there, I was taken there at night. Taken there at around 9 o'clock, 9 p.m. And I was admitted at 10:15, according to the record. And at 11:30, two doctors wrote certificates certifying me as mentally ill. I was already incarcerated. I was already in isolation, and they refused to give me a psychiatric workup. I asked them for a workup that would include projective testing, because I knew that if they would do that, that they would see that what I was saying was true, that I was actually being harassed, that I was not delusional, and they wouldn't give this testing to me.
So you had told them about the harassment, and
I told them about the harassment. I told them I had seen the therapist on the outside, who knew about it, who thought that it was a cult that was harassing me. They would not speak to her. They would not speak to witnesses. They did everything to suppress information that would have shown what the truth was. They wouldn't give me the test. The only test they wanted to give me was a gynecological exam.
And
I wouldn't let them. I don't know why they wanted to give it to me. But it was the first. They was ordered the first thing upon my arrival there.
So rather than seriously take your account into, or your allegations into account, they've just simply labeled you as mentally ill.
Yes, they did.
Did they actually administer drugs to you, or?
They were ordered for me, and I refused to take them the first morning that I was there. So, as I was saying, I went there at 9 o'clock at night, and the first morning at 8 o'clock or 7:30, whenever they give out meds, they wanted me to take them. I refused. I told them that I don't need them. There is nothing wrong with me except that I am being harassed. And they persisted every day in asking me to take them. I wrote out a letter to the director of the hospital asking for a hearing to determine whether my incarceration was valid. And instead, when the unit chief found out that I had done this, he came to me and said that he understood that I had requested a hearing, that if there was any hearing, it would be the hospital's hearing to put me on medication, and that he was going to ask for 60 days with forced medication. So he suggested that I not go to court, that it wouldn't be therapeutic, that I just take the medication and forget about it. So I couldn't do that. I couldn't just take the medication because I felt that I would never be okay if I did that. I would never get free. I would never be able to think, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So even though it was with the threat of if you don't win in court, we are going to drag you back here and inject you, I still insisted that I wanted to have a hearing, and I did go, and the judge ruled that they could not force medication on me, and because the papers that they sent to the court and because the doctor said in court that I was suicidal, the judge said that I should be committed for 30 more days, and he allowed me to move to another hospital. So at the next hospital, they evaluated me, and I was released almost immediately. I think I went there on a Friday, and on Monday, the attorney for that hospital came to me and said that I was free to leave.
So about how long were you at Cornell?
I was at Cornell for, 21 days, I think, maybe 22.
Okay. And so was it at that time that you began to suspect that you were being used?
Well, at that time, I could no longer just, you know, let it ride and try to think, well, what's going on? It just totally consumed me. From the moment that I was knocked on the floor in that lobby, my mind began spinning about what is going on here. It was like a computer just tracking down every strange thing that ever happened in my life and trying to figure out what started this. I immediately connected the being kidnapped to all of the harassment that I had just gone through, but I still didn't know who was behind it. And even when I got out of the hospital, even when I got out of the second hospital, I still didn't know who was behind it. I just knew that it had to be somebody or some organization that had a lot of money, because I was being followed by different kinds of vehicles, limousines, vans, people followed me on the bus, there was just an enormous amount of money going into this, I figured. And so a few weeks after I got out of the hospital, or maybe only 1 week after I got out, I went to see a friend of mine, a woman named Nancy, who is a therapist and has a lot of experience. She has been a psychologist for a long time. She's a psychoanalyst, and I think I've known her about 20 years now. And she knew me, and she knew me in many different roles. I worked for a while in the mental health center that she runs, and I knew her socially, and I worked side by side with her, and we were both very young therapists. So I went to see her, and I said, "What do you suppose is going on here?" And she helped me figure it out, that probably this was somehow connected to an experiment that I participated in Canada, in Vancouver, in 1973. I think it was 1973. It might have been 1974. I can figure it out exactly.
And this was your experience at Hollywood Hospital?
Yeah, that's right, at Hollywood Hospital, where I went to participate in an LSD experiment.
And how did you get involved in that?
That came from a psychiatrist in New York. A psychiatrist. I was going to therapy to a person in New York City, a psychologist, and when I quit therapy with him, I wanted to quit, he asked me to go and talk to his supervisor. And when I went and talked to his supervisor, I got referred to this experiment in Vancouver. And I was not opposed to it, but I didn't have any idea of the ramifications of it. So my friend Nancy and I figured out that that was probably connected to the hospitalization and all the things that had been happening preceding the hospitalization.
At that time, were you aware of Hollywood Hospital's involvement in
LSD and mind control? I still wasn't aware of Hollywood's involvement. And a lot of pieces were missing, but it just seemed like this was on the right track, you know? It felt right. Then in that summer, the kidnapping was in May. Then during the summer, so this would have been just a few months later, it would have been after I talked to Nancy, I was watching a movie, and in the beginning of the movie, they had a prologue that included a clipping from the New York Times. And the clipping said something like, "The CIA is looking for a drug that will create a perfect spy by creating amnesia for specific events." And when I saw that, that just rang a bell. I thought, if that would be true, that there is such a thing, that could explain so much. And the date of that clipping was August 1977, so of course I couldn't wait to get to the library. And when I did get to the library, that was the beginning of the discovery of the truth. In the library, I found that article and many other articles that were written around that time, and that was the time of the Senate subcommittee investigation of the CIA mind control. And so it gave names of places where the centers where the mind control had been going on.
Mm-hmm.
And I discovered, though there were only 13 listed in that particular set of papers from the Times, I discovered that some of those were places that I had been.
And what were those places?
Syracuse University and Penn State and Cornell. I think those were mentioned in the 77 newspaper articles. So that when seeing that, and it also mentioned that there were 85 known centers for mind control research in the United States, but it didn't name the others in those articles in the Times. So I wrote down all of the places that I thought possibly I had been experimented on, and I went to the Times, and I found a reporter who had been involved in writing those stories in the 70s. And I said, "Could you just tell me if these places were also involved?" And he said, "Yes, they were, but don't jump to any conclusions," he said. But I was confident then that I was really on the right track.
And
this event, this hospitalization, was just one in a series of events related to mind control. But that was really the first that I knew of it, was after I saw that article in the newspaper.
So you have been used in quite a number of locations and experiments. I wonder if we can talk about each of these that...
We can talk about all of them, and they go right back until I was 2 years old.
Why don't we start chronologically? What happened when you were 2 years old?
Well, actually, I just discovered this... I always knew this. I never forgot it. It isn't something that was repressed, but I never fit this into the whole picture until about a month ago. When I was 2 years old, my father told me, he came in my playroom and he had what I thought was a mousetrap, and he put it down on the floor and he put it under a cabinet that was in my room, and he told me, "Don't touch this, it will bite you." And I think that he put chocolate in it as bait. And I didn't touch it that day. But the next day when he was gone to work, I was trying to figure out how I could get the candy out of there without making it bite me. So I touched it, and it snapped, and I went running to my mother with this trap on my hand, and she wouldn't take it off. She just shut me in my playroom. And I don't know, I can't remember how I ever did get it off, and I spoke to her about it last week, and it's interesting, she can't remember either. She remembers that it happened, and in fact, she said, no, that wasn't a mouse trap, that was a rat trap. And she doesn't know why she wouldn't take it off. And she said, "I told your father that he shouldn't do that." Well, that was the beginning. And that is part of the Greenbaum programming. Now, this is very interesting. The Greenbaum programming was written about in the past few years, and I read what was written, but I didn't connect it to being part of my life when I read about it. Different pieces had to fall into place first. And the reason that I came to realize this thing about the mousetrap was because about a month ago, someone asked me if I had any unusual childhood diseases. First I said, "Did you ever have any childhood diseases?" And I said, "Well, sure." And they said, "Well, what ones did you have?" I said, "I had all of them." But they pressed me on it. They said, "Well, did you have any that were unusual, or were there unusual circumstances around any of them?" And when somebody pushes me on something like that, and it doesn't make any logical sense that they're interested, it gets me thinking. And so I started thinking and thinking. And then I realized, oh, my God, when I was 7 years old, I did have something unusual happen. And that was that I was sleeping one night, and I woke up, and these three little guys came through my window, like little men, I thought they were. And I can't remember exactly what they looked like, except I remember at the time I described them as being similar to the cutouts in the back of our dining room chairs. We had straight-back dining room chairs that had a little design cut out of them. And then, after these three ladies, three little men, a lady talked to me. And that was all very strange. But 2 days later, I think that was on a Friday night, so it was Saturday morning when I woke up. And on Monday, I had a temperature, a very high temperature, and I had to go to the hospital. I had scarlet fever. When I was in the hospital, I saw this priest from my parish come up to the window and talk to me. Now, I was on a high floor, so this was not a possibility in reality. And after I was in the hospital for a few weeks, I had a high temperature and I was very sick. I think I stayed 3 weeks. And after I got out, I asked my mother about this. I said, "Well, what about these three little guys that I saw and the lady, and what about the priest coming up to my window?" And she said, "Well, those were hallucinations because you had a temperature of 106. And I accepted that, and I never thought about it again. I never thought about it again until a month ago when somebody started pushing me to discover if I ever had any unusual circumstances surrounding childhood illnesses. So once I accepted that possibly that was an experiment, and I knew when I was in the hospital at that time that I was one of the first children in the country to be given penicillin. The nurse told me that. She told me that I was lucky, that it was just becoming available, you know, for... It was available a little earlier than that, but it was for the soldiers, you know.
So that would have been about 1945 or so?
Yes. Mm-hmm. I was born in 1938, so I say I was 7 years old when it happened.
Now, what
makes you think that it was not possibly caused by the fever that...
Oh, well, because I didn't have a fever when it started. When the three little guys came through my window and the lady talked to me, I didn't have a fever. I wasn't sick yet. That was just an ordinary day that I went to school and everything, you know? And so then two more days passed and I was sick. And so then that set me thinking, well, maybe this was an experiment. Maybe I was part of an experiment. And then after that, I read that Dr. Esther Brooks, who I believe that I was one of that project, the Esther Brooks project, wanted parents to allow their children to be observed. And he promised that they would not be interfered with, but they would simply be observed, and the parents would be paid for this. And so then I got to thinking, well, maybe, you know, maybe that's what happened to me. I was in this experiment. I was 7 years old. Maybe my father and mother let me be observed, or maybe my father let me be observed. And then I remembered that this Greenbaum thing, which couldn't be denied in my case, because I have that big painting that I showed you that has the complete Greenbaum symbolism in it.
The subliminal art.
Yes, you have that. You have a copy of that.
Yes, I do.
A small copy of it. It has all the Greek letters. It has all of the symbols that would go with those Greek letters.
Now,
and that is definitely a subliminal piece representing Greenbaum programming. And
now,
then going back to the two-year-old incident of having a rat trap on my hand, that is known, a known procedure in the Greenbaum programming.
That particular act of using a mouse trap?
Yes, it's been written about. And if you can get, Wayne, the Greenbaum programming lecture off the web, off the World Wide Web.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure it's at Mind Control Forum.
Right.
And it states in there that this is one of the things that they do to condition the child.
What do you think was the purpose of inflicting that kind of pain?
Well, I've thought about it a lot. One thing is that it terminates your trust in your mother completely. I mean, to run to her in such pain and to have her shut you in your room. So, there you are. You better become self-reliant very fast.
Was there any other events that happened in your childhood that would indicate that your parents were involved in experimentation of any kind?
No, I think that... when you are when the parents in this particular program that I just mentioned, I read about in Esther Brooks' writing, were told that they would, the only requirement of them was that they have at least three children. And so I know that shortly after my third sister was born, my father won the lottery. So I thought maybe that was the payment. You know. I can never prove any of these things, except, I mean, we could prove what I'm telling you, because other people in my family know these facts, but we could never prove that they're related to Esther Brooks' quest for subjects.
So do you remember being, or meeting, or being involved in George Esther Brooks' experimentation?
No one ever told me that it was Esther Brooks' experimentation, but I've had to figure it out. And I think I possibly met him at Syracuse. I think he might have been the person who interrogated me at Syracuse University. I'm not sure.
Okay, but so after the 7-year-old experience, what happened after that that made you
suspect?
I don't
think anything ever happened after that until I was in college.
Mm-hmm.
I think that...
And this was at Penn State?
No, I first went to Oswego. I was experimented on at Penn State. But I went to Oswego State Teachers College, which is on the Great Lakes. It's up on Lake Ontario.
Mm-hmm.
And people helped me discover this, you know, actually. I thought that I was selected when I was a senior in college, possibly, because several times that year and several times in my junior year, my picture appeared in the local newspaper. So I thought, well, maybe that's when it happened. And I was talking to Jan Klimkowski about this. He's at the BBC, the one you just mentioned earlier.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, well, did you do anything earlier in your college year that would have called, in college years, that would have called attention to you? And I said that in my freshman year of college, in my psychology class, which involved four sections of students, because every freshman had to take this, there was a teacher who taught all the class. One teacher taught all the sections, and there must have been 400 at least students in all of those sections. And she gave quizzes for and midterms and a final exam. And on the first midterm, I think, or the first quiz, I scored higher than anybody in any of those sections by many points, too many points for it to be a natural happening, according to her. It was beyond statistical probability. So she watched me. She thought I was cheating. And then on the next test, I got about the same thing happened. I scored like 15 or 20 points higher than anybody in any section. And I didn't know this until after I graduated from college and I met her. And she came to me and she told me this story. And she said, you know, on the first test you scored 11 or 15 points higher. On the next test you scored 20 points higher. On the next test you scored, you know, so many points higher. And I knew that this was beyond what would be expected or possible. So I want to know, what did you do? Did you cheat? And so she and I talked about it, and I didn't cheat. I just I told her that I could tell what was important to her, and those were the things that I studied. And
what were the tests of again?
I beg your pardon?
What was the subject of the tests?
A psychology.
Mm-hmm.
It was just a psychology test. It was called Frontiers of the Mind. Actually, was the name of the course. And so what I think happened there is that all of the psychology departments in the United States had been invited by Donovan and whoever worked with him to sort of scout out people. And this is when the OSS was set up.
Mm-hmm.
And so they were all participating in one way or another. And they were probably glad to do it. And they were looking at that time, I understand, to find people who were highly intuitive. People who were intuitive. I don't know if that's what she got from this test, you know, that I must be very intuitive to be able to score so much higher than other kids in my class. But she remembered it anyway. And 4 years later, she came to me after I graduated and asked me about it, how I did it. So I had always been intuitive, and I think now that probably that was why I was selected, because of that happening in my freshman year. Then in the second half of my freshman year, I called attention to myself again by fighting with my psychology teacher. It was the first week of school, and they gave out the outline for the class, and I could see from the outline and that it wouldn't be possible to do all the assignments based on the number of kids in the class and the number of hours that the library was open. And back in those days, they didn't have copying like they do now. So if there was one copy on reserve in the library and 60 kids had to read it, then you had to make 60 different hours available to read it. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So this professor gave us an impossible schedule. And I went to the dean, and I told the dean, this isn't going to work. And that professor had to change his agenda for the term. So I did twice in my freshman year call attention to myself, and mm-hmm. I don't know if that's why I was selected. But.
So, and again, who do you believe was behind the selection of people that apparently that they would be using in some kind of mind
experiments? Well, I think, you know, from what I just told you, it's possible that I was volunteered when I was a child, when I was a little girl, when I was 2 years old or younger. Maybe my father thought that it was his patriotic duty. I don't know, you know. But so that would have meant that I was just sort of like in the program. And then later, I was selected for another aspect of it. Maybe I was selected to be testing penicillin. Maybe those little people that I saw coming through my window were actually a test of some kind of technology that could later be used to trick people or make people think that aliens are coming in.
So some kind of technology to create the illusion of something?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And Astor Brooks wrote in his dissertation, and I have that, that we... Oh, his dissertation, by the way, was on... it was about measures of intelligence by race, is what it was. I can't think of the exact name of it.